How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer here on Wrestling Observer Radio. It is June 4th, 2013, here at figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. We got Raw to talk about tonight, and a bunch of news as well. Your questions, which you're going to send to mailbag at wrestlingobserver.com. And Raw tonight, I thought was a I thought it was a pretty good show. There was some really good wrestling in spots, and it also felt very long for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe a lot of long matches did it, but by the time the main event came with Kurt Axel and John Cena, I was like, wow, the show's gone on a long time. But the Daniel Bryan match I thought was very good with Ryback. The six man went a little long, but the finish was awesome. And obviously going up against the NBA game, they had a lot of downtime in the middle of the show when I guess they just may have presumed that people were watching something else. I don't know. But what did you think of the show?
I thought it was really good overall. Yeah, I you know, 3 hour show is always going to feel long. But I thought, you know, again, yeah, I mean, I thought pretty good show. You know, the McMahons being out with Triple H. I mean, that was kind of like the idea that I had heard originally, you know, when they did the injury thing. But it certainly wasn't supposed to come this soon. But, you know, I mean, it's interesting. It's like you bring the McMahons back to combat a week when, you know, you expect that you're not going to do well, or do you wait for a week that you can really do well and they can bring you the most viewers? And I guess this was the decision they made. This was the week that, you know, they were afraid of, you know, a bad number. And I think that maybe having the way, you know, having them back and everything like that, maybe that should help and it won't be so bad. We'll see.
All right. The show, the big angle at the beginning of the show was Stephanie McMahon coming out. And she came down to the ring and she announced that Triple H was thinking he was going to be wrestling Curtis Axel tonight, but in fact, he was not going to be wrestling Curtis Axel. And she essentially cut a total heel promo, saying that the fans need to stop thinking about themselves. They need to quit being selfish. They need to think about Triple H and herself and the family and her husband's own well-being. He nearly died several weeks ago. So this, of course, brought out Vince. Everybody cheered because they thought he was going to come out and say that Triple H was wrestling. But he sided with Stephanie and pretty much turned heel as well, said, come on, people. You know, you don't boo my daughter, Kurt Axel, beneath Triple H. He's not wrestling tonight. And they're both shooting down this idea when suddenly the Shield's music hits. And
they also, Vince also, like, was brought up the Kofi Kingston thing on SmackDown and how, you know, when he was injured, the fans kept chanting one more time, which actually led them to chant one more time right here.
So the Shield,
this is family entertainment. It's not blood sport.
That's right. So the Shield starts coming down through the crowd and the announcers freak out and they're saying Steph and Vince need to get out of the ring for their own good. And they go to commercial and when they come back,
they were out of the ring for their own good.
They were gone.
Yep.
So we had the rematch from SmackDown. Randy Orton, Kane, and Daniel Bryan against The Shield. And they had a long, long six-man match. I don't want to say it dragged, but certainly it was a very long match for an opening segment. And there were points where I realized this was a long match. But last 2 minutes...
I thought this match was really, really good.
I thought...
I mean, I didn't think it dragged at all. Because I don't mind like the long match early in the show. It's like if it was late in the show, I think it would drag a lot more. Early, you know, you're kind of refreshed. And these guys are really good. All of the guys. I mean, I just thought like, you know, Randy Orton's just is great. Daniel Bryan's great, and they were in the ring a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, Daniel Bryan was the focus of the match, really.
So they do the match, and as noted, lots of different near falls near the end. And finally, Bryan does his comeback. There's a schmoz, and in the middle of all sorts of things happening, Ambrose hits Daniel Bryan with the headlock DDT and gets the pin.
Yeah, well, Roman Reigns threw Randy Orton into Daniel Bryan. And so, you know, that was the thing. And Daniel Bryan did this basically this exact same spot. Not exactly, but similar that he'd done SmackDown, where when he did the hot tag, he just destroyed everyone. You know, he did Hurricane Rana on Rollins off the top, right onto Dean Ambrose, Tope onto Roman Reigns, missile dropkick on Dean Ambrose, had the no-lock on Roman Reigns, and, you know, Rollins made the save. And I think, let's see, Roman Reigns speared Kane. Orton did the RKO on Rollins. But Reigns then threw Orton into Daniel Bryan, and that set up the finish right there. And Orton said he was sorry for bumping into Daniel Bryan, even though he didn't do it on purpose. And Daniel Bryan was like, you know, that's an apology, you know, and went off on, you know, the reason you wouldn't really apologize is because you think I'm the weak link. And then just kind of went off from there.
That's right. This was all backstage after the match. Bryan went absolutely crazy, yelling at them and claiming that, you know, he's not the weak link. They think he's the weak link. He's very upset. And he eventually later on announced that he was going to prove he was not the weak link by having another match here on the show. And he was going to beat respect into somebody. And that somebody ended up being Ryback later. Mm-hmm. We had Triple H arriving, went looking for Vince. Found him and his wife, wanted to know what the hell was going on. And Vince said, listen, we need to talk. You're not wrestling. And Triple H said, yes, I am. And Vince said, no, you're not. Triple H said, yes, I am. Who's going to stop me? And Stephanie's in the background looking at her dad and looking at her husband and caught between them. And Vince finally gets in his face and he says, listen, don't do something tonight that you're going to regret. And as he says this, he has a piece of paper that he's all rolled up, and he bumps Triple H in the chest with it, leaves the paper with him, walks out, door closes, and I guess it is left to be determined what is on the paper, but presumably something involving his role as the, whatever he is, COO? What is Triple H officially in this company?
COO is the TV role.
COO.
You know, he Stephanie called him Paul. Actually, a couple times in the thing. I guess they're old. This one's real. And Vince said, basically said that he's making a decision based on ego. And Triple H was completely offended because, of course, Vince makes decisions based on ego constantly. And he just was really upset about that line that it was his ego talking.
So then we have the Usos and the Primetime Players. In the ring, the Usos were very good. Match was fine, but absolutely not a single solitary person cared about this match. And Usos won, and I have no idea what any of this had to do with anything, really. But
well, the whole idea was that they're pushing that the Usos are going to be getting a shot at Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns for the tag team title. I mean, that was the idea of just getting that thing going. And the Usos,
when and why?
As far as why, I guess to give them a new challenge, and when probably pretty soon. Hopefully not the pay per view.
That would seem like a gigantic step down for the Shield.
Yes, it would. Even though they're trying to like elevate the Usos, you know, they sort of repackaged them. Not really. I mean, it was the only real difference was that they got face paint now, and that was about it. They're very good, but yeah, the crowd was. You know, the crowd was into the Usos more than they should, but overall, yeah, I mean, the crowd, actually, like, a lot of the stuff, the crowd from this point on was kind of like, meh, not that hot for a lot of the stuff from the, you know, up until really, like, the end of the Daniel Bryan and Ryback match. Because even the Daniel Bryan-Ryback match, really the first half to two-thirds, the crowd wasn't into it at all. But it just got so freaking good that they, you know, they had no choice, and they really did like Daniel Bryan. But yeah, here was just kind of like, you know, they weren't really gonna, I don't know, you know, it's just hard, I guess.
Then we had the your favorite match again, Big E Langston, Alberto Del Rio, I think they claimed it was a rubber match.
Yeah, best of five, I guess.
They've each wrestled each other 50 times. And anyway, this time, Del Rio had the arm breaker on, and Big E Langston was fighting. And Del Rio managed to turn it into a cradle. And for all of you complaining that Big E Langston needs a bigger singlet, never was there more evidence to your point than tonight. Saw way too much of Big E Langston on this finish. It's very unfortunate. And he got pinned. AJ was upset. And
no Ziggler on the show.
No Dolph Ziggler here tonight. That's right.
Who else wasn't there was Swagger. They did a thing with the app, and they showed Coulter at one point, but no Swagger.
Yeah.
And I don't think he wasn't there. I mean, at the building, because I asked about that. And, nobody really thought about it, but he wasn't there, which is interesting. He hasn't been around for a couple weeks now.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't get pulled over, everybody, on the road to WrestleMania. Sheamus and Cody Rhodes, they had it was a decent match. Sheamus beat him with the brogue kick. Damian Sandow was there in comedy. He has vowed that this Friday on SmackDown, he is going to have another test of skill. Cannot wait for that segment. So after the match, Sheamus goes outside, and he goes up to Sandow, and he offers a handshake, and Sandow wants nothing of this. And Sheamus offers him a handshake again. Sandow ends up just kind of slapping his hand away. And then Sheamus beat the crap out of him.
They just slapped him in the ear.
Yeah. Knocked his headset off. Left him on his ass. What a jerk.
Looks like they're going to do this match, Sheamus and Sandow, at the pay-per-view.
What a match.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just something that, like, Sheamus is kind of odd man out. And they figured that we just got to, you know, we got to put him on the pay-per-view. Because, you know, they've done, like, angle after angle. And they've got nothing else for Sheamus. I think that's where they're going.
They also made sure to get a plug in for Meredith Whitney's new book, which comes out tomorrow, JBL's Wife. So that was very
State
nice.
State of the Estate, something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
State of the State, something like that.
Now we had Triple H and Stephanie backstage, and he's all pissed off, and he leaves. And he says, I'm leaving now because I don't want to have to go out and kick the grandfather of our children's ass. But next week, he says, next week when Raw opens up, I'm going to be in the ring and I'm going to be wrestling Curtis Axel. And all I could think was, this week they had Steph and Vince try. So next week, they're going to have to trot out the kids. Mega guilt.
No, I don't think so.
Mega guilt to keep Triple H out of the ring.
Yeah.
Got to be somebody else out there because I don't think he's wrestling Curtis Axel next Monday. Maybe he is. I don't know. We had the replay of Ryback destroying Kofi, and the announcers then announced that they said Kofi was put through the table three times, and it aggravated a pre-existing elbow injury, which necessitated surgery on him. And I thought, wow, it's not like he was beat up real bad by these tables. No, it was a pre-existing injury they had to bring up. Just, I guess, try and make this more realistic. And then they cut back to Daniel Bryan and the Ryback. And Ryback, during this promo, announces that he caused Kofi Kingston to get surgery on Thursday. So he broke kayfabe with SmackDown being taped.
Right. That's right, because the angle aired on TV on Friday.
That's right.
Yeah, that was a big mistake.
Yep. So basically, Daniel Bryan ran into him.
It's amazing. It got through all those channels, too.
Yeah. I don't know how. Or he just happened to just screw up live. I don't know.
I mean, he could have. He could have screwed up live.
So Bryan is storming around backstage, kicking stuff. Ryback comes up and tells him to calm down. I don't even know why Ryback's so concerned. But this makes Daniel Bryan very upset. And he tears Ryback a new one and says he's going to whip his ass tonight here on the show. A lot of great passion from Daniel Bryan here on this show.
Yeah, not from Ryback.
Ryback just kind of laughed at him a little bit.
Yeah. Ryback delivery of the lines was not good.
Never is.
Yeah, it was worse than usual, though. I was just like, really this monotone, fake, I'm reading my lines kind of delivery.
Heyman and Curtis Axler backstage meet with Vince. Vince puts over Curtis, says, in fact, despite my son-in-law challenging you next week, there will be no match. He's not wrestling. But before you guys try and get out of here, tonight Curtis Axel is going to wrestle, and he's going to wrestle John Cena. And Curtis Axel did not look too happy about this, but Heyman's like, great! So they made it a no DQ match. They announced Miz TV with Randy Orton, Kane, and Daniel Bryan is going to be on SmackDown this week. And on main event, it's Antonio Cesaro and Sheamus for the next 12 hours or so. Then that'll change.
Yeah.
Fandango and the Great Khali. This was quite the segment here. So they have a match. Great Khali wins when Fandango bails. As he's bailing, Miz and Wade Barrett end up on the stage. And Wade Barrett lays out Miz with his bull hammer elbow. So they go to commercial, they come back, and Miz is now wrestling Wade Barrett. They have a quick match. Fandango comes back out. He distracts Wade. Miz rolls up Wade and turns it into a figure four and gets a submission. So I guess this is further build towards Miz, Wade Barrett, and Fandango in a three-way, I guess, for the title.
Yeah, for the pay-per-view.
Yeah.
So.
Had a contract signing. This is kind of weird.
Yeah, it is really weird.
Jericho and Paul out there, and you know, they were great. Jericho's great, Paul's great, but they Paul signs a contract, and then he says, "Jericho, your turn." Jericho's about to sign, and Paul says, "I want you to realize that this match is taking place in Chicago. That's Punk's hometown." He's going to be cheered. You are going to be booed. They're going to hate you. They're going to mock you. And Jericho's like, well, maybe we should do the match at the pay-per-view.
In SummerSlam in
SummerSlam.
Los Angeles.
In L.A., yeah. And Paul's like, not happening. So then Jericho's like, well, how about we do it in Madison Square Garden? Paul said, nope, not happening either. So he says, well, how about we do it right here in Hartford? And everybody cheered, and Heyman said, no, that's not happening. So Jericho,
it'd be difficult because Punk wasn't there.
Yeah. So after being shot down three times, Jericho's like, all right, I'll sign the contract. So he signs the contract, and then he gets up and he says, Paul, stand up. And Paul reluctantly stands up. And then Jericho says, we need to file this somewhere, either your attorney, my attorney, or somewhere else. And he commands Heyman to undo his shirt. And then he proceeds to roll the contract and put it down the front of Heyman's pants. And then it ended. I have no idea what this was all about.
Yeah, kind of a weak ending,
I'll say.
Yeah, it was like they had a nice deal. The thing I noticed on this was with Heyman, it's like he really, you know, when he was doing all these lines, he really said nothing. Like, it was just very predictable what he would say. But his delivery was so good that it was still good. I mean, that was the key to the segment. They,
yep.
You know, really, like, neither guy really said much of anything. But
they said nothing very well.
Heyman said nothing very well, and Jericho was good. It was a good segment, you know, as far as, you know, no Punk, even for the contract signing. And I'm sure that'll probably play into something down the line. I don't know. I'm feeling like a Punk turn. Pretty soon. Sooner than it should be.
I'm thinking it's very possible. Punk gets upset that Paul did all this without his knowledge or something like that.
Yep, exactly.
He's on a summer vacation and Paul booked him for a match. Now he's pissed. We had AJ and the Bellas against Caitlyn and the Funkadactyls in a match. How long did this go? 3 minutes?
4.5. Crowd was really dead for this.
I'll say. So they did a match and did the deal where AJ was going to get a tag, but she jumped off the apron, laughed at the Bellas, and Caitlyn got a spear and a pin, and not much to this except girls damn near killing themselves.
Yeah, not good. Not good at all.
No. And they add some footage for the Total Divas show, which debuts next month, actually. I still... I know there's a lot of bad television on E.
Hold on, I've got to switch phones.
All right, I'll continue ranting.
Okay.
I can't believe this this show is an hour long every week. I can't believe it. I must see this. Must see this.
Once.
Yeah, probably.
After once, the show may not be that good.
Yeah. So Kane came up to Daniel Bryan backstage. Said Bryan had nothing to prove. Bryan said, God damn it, I do have something to prove. And he started ranting and screaming. And Kane ultimately said, fine, you're on your own. And he abandoned Daniel Bryan. There you go. Another Wyatt family promo aired. Everybody cheered. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had Daniel Bryan and Ryback. Long match. Really good match. Daniel Bryan is awesome. He brings the best out of Ryback. They wrestled forever. He put him in the yes lock. Ryback barely got the ropes. So there were a lot of really cool spots. Daniel Bryan is so good at being
really
a
good tonight.
Small guy that makes you believe that he's kicking Ryback's ass. That takes talent.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, and actually they're thinking in this direction too, but he needs to be, at this point, I think he needs to be the number two babyface in the company behind Cena. You know, where you know, and like, you know, and out there, you know, I mean, in a big time program with either Punk or maybe Ziggler.
Sounds great to me.
What?
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, I mean, he really needs to be. I mean, he can get any match over with. I mean, if he can get that with Ryback, a long match. You know, long matches aren't exactly Ryback's specialty. Ryback really isn't very good, and if he can get that out of him. And the point is, he got the crowd going, and the crowd's really into him right now. So it's not like always some technical wrestler who works good, but people don't care. I mean, they really react better to him than, I mean, maybe not Orton, you know, but not far off either. And probably, this, you know, and actually, you know, peak better right now because he's kind of the hot thing right now. But he really should be, you know, like, I mean, he shouldn't be a heel, and he should be a single, and he should break away from Kane. And he should be going for a championship. And it's probably going to happen, too.
Good. It was awesome here tonight. They did a DQ finish when Ryback just went outside, grabbed a table, powerbombed him through it. And he was leaving him laying there. John Cena ran down to make the save, which ended up leading to the main event segment, which was Cena and Axel. It was fine. The Curtis Axel imaginary push continues as he's doing this match, and Ryback comes out and he throws Cena through a table that's leaning against the dasher boards, and Curtis Axel beats John Cena again via count out. And again, although he was given the victory, this whole thing was still all about John Cena and Ryback. And
well, they're the ones in the main event on the pay-per-view.
Well, they are, but still, I don't know. The Curtis Axel push where he's always like, he gets a fluke win.
That's the whole gimmick. I mean, the whole gimmick from the start is that he always wins over these guys, but he doesn't really beat them, and he claims that he did, and that's where the heat's supposed to be.
I understand that's where it's supposed to be, but I don't see that working.
I'm not saying it's working like he's super over right now, but people are getting... You know, I mean, they see him as somebody, which, you know, is at least a start.
I think they see him as somebody because he's being pushed as somebody with Paul Heyman.
Yeah.
But I don't think the fake victories over John Cena and Triple H are doing anything for him.
The fact he's in there, it's a story for him. I mean, it's doing more for him than the real victory over Sin Cara.
Well, Sin Cara.
Yeah.
There's got to be like a Kane-level guy that he can actually beat.
Well, he shouldn't beat these two guys. I mean, Triple H he's not going to beat because he's probably going to do a program with him. And Cena he shouldn't be beating because Cena's the world champion, and unless they're going to go right to the championship match with those two. And it does not look like that they're doing that right away. I mean, they may do that. But at that point, I just don't see him winning the championship that soon. But who knows? I mean, again, they want to make stars. That's what they do when they want to make stars. They can go all the way.
How about a one-off match with Randy Orton that
he wins? He can do that. I don't see anything wrong with it, but only I wouldn't have him beat Randy Orton until like 3 weeks before a pay-per-view where he's wrestling John Cena for the championship.
Sure.
Because if he beats Randy Orton clean, then where does he go on the pay-per-view? Because, you know, it's got to be Cena, and at that point, you've got to have Cena's got to clear out and finish this program before it's the right time for him to be beating Randy Orton.
As noted, we've got main event tomorrow, which is the Sheamus Antonio Cesaro match until they change it. And that's pretty much the only thing they've announced for that show yet. And no big notes after Raw went off the air, no appreciation nights or anything like that. So that is the Raw report. One more week until one more Raw and then the pay-per-view. So we'll see what they do next week as far as building up all the rest of the matches.
Yeah, I mean, well, let's see. We've got they still have to wait until Ziggler gets cleared. Evidently, I'm going with the impression he wasn't cleared, because I think if he was, they should have at least had him, get involved in that Langston match and then announce their match for the pay-per-view. The fact that they didn't means that he probably wasn't cleared. What I'm guessing, unless they do that to for SmackDown.
We're 2 weeks out, and there's only two matches announced. That's kind of depressing.
Well, Ziggler kind of thrown a monkey wrench into one of them. I mean, we know the Fandango, Barrett, and Miz match. Probably AJ, Caitlin. Although, they've never really made that clear. And again, they probably should have by now. They don't, but I guess it doesn't matter on that one. I mean, as far as the matches that matter, that are going to be ticket sellers, they can't do the Ziggler match yet, so they didn't, and they got the other two. They're already out there. And Sheamus with Sandow, it doesn't matter that they announced that this week or next week, because that's not selling any extra tickets. So it kind of is what it is. I mean, and let's face it, the whole show is really Cena and Ryback anyway. They're doing three matches. So that's really, everything else on the pay-per-view is going to get short-shrifted.
All right, there was another match that, I guess the best way to explain it is, there was a UFC match that fell apart, and they started working on a replacement match, and it appeared that match was a go, and then that match fell apart. What happened with Chael Sonnen?
Looks like Chael Sonnen and Shogun are going to be fighting on August 17th in Boston. As far as why it fell apart, I don't know, but I think that we will get a story tomorrow. But what if that story is the accurate story, we're gonna get Chael Sonnen. The thing is, UFC Tonight's tomorrow night. So, and Chael hosts UFC Tonight. So logic tells me that we are going to get promo from Chael, and there we will get something. It's a promo. Don't forget that. So it looks like they're, that's what they're aiming for. As of a couple hours ago, it definitely was not set for Boston, but that was...
So was it Visa or was it something else? Because I heard Visa and the front page reported nothing about a Visa.
I don't know. I've had people absolutely denied to me the Visa story, but that may be that, logic would tell you, given what it is and everything like that, that he was going to have difficulty getting, on this kind of notice, getting into Canada with the Visa. Logic would tell you that, but I have had people deny it, and the idea that they wanted the match in Boston because they didn't want to just feed Chael to him, and, Chael, let's face it, Chael is, what kind of shape is he going to be in, on 2 weeks' notice? And I think that the feeling is that they don't want to abuse Chael like that, even though Chael is perfectly fine. So if they're going to do the fight, they'll do the fight as a fair fight, and they're giving both guys a chance to get a full training camp in. So I think that that's the thing there, and kind of screwed for Winnipeg. They've lost 4 of their top 6 fighters on the show, with no real replacement. Although I guess Roy and Nelson and
Stipe Miocic was an added fight that was not originally scheduled on the show. You know, they kind of like called Roy up to get on the show when Barao fell off. So that was kind of a make good. And now it's just too late to do another make good because we're only 10 days out. There was nobody else. They talked to Vanderlei about fighting Shogun, and Vanderlei turned it down. So they just couldn't get whatever it was. They couldn't or wouldn't, and probably couldn't is probably the better word, put together. There was talk that maybe Hua didn't want it with no training because he trained for a completely different fighter. Again, whatever it is, I think that it'll all be out in the next 24 hours. A version will be out in the next 24 hours.
So last week I watched the Hogan-Andre main event match with the Earl Hebner taking the place of his brother, the evil heel referee angle. And so tonight's first mailbag question is, in regards to that angle, was it well known throughout the business that Earl Hebner was a referee for Jim Crockett Promotions prior to the Hogan-Andre match from the February 88 main event show?
Well, I mean, if you were following the business, yes, it was absolutely well known. They operate on the premise that nothing but WWE mattered. And I think, a very good percentage of the fans knew who Earl Hebner was and knew that Earl Hebner and Dave Hebner were twins. But, there was a strong percentage that didn't know that as well. So a little bit of both.
What was the backstory to setting that thing up?
They came up with the idea, and they called up Dave called up Earl, told Earl to give his notice, and he was going to get a higher-paying job, and Earl gave his notice, told Jim Crockett, asked Jim Crockett not to tell anybody what he was leaving for, and that was it.
So the day of the show, were you aware of what they were going to do?
No, I was not. I did not know that Earl had jumped, no, on that day. I mean, as soon as he ran in, obviously, I knew, but no.
Talked about this on another show, but Hogan gets screwed and had the title for 4 years, evil heel referee, million dollar man, bottom off and everything like that. And they go to commercial, they come back, and Tito Santana, Strikeforce, is in the ring. And Vince or Jesse or somebody's like, Gene Okerlund's in the back, and he's got Hulk Hogan. They go to Hulk Hogan, who's just been screwed out of the title, and Hogan is like, he's weeping. He's so sad, and he's so angry, and he's so pissed off, and he's filled with rage, and he's ranting and raving about referees and money flying out of the guy's pocket and all this, and I was just like, boy, things have changed. John Cena comes out the next day after losing the title, and it's nothing but comedy.
Yeah,
and that was something else to watch. This mm-hmm. guy cared that he lost the title.
Yeah, well, they made the title important. When a guy has it for 4 years and he loses it, it's going to be a lot bigger than when you do it this way. But this is just the way it is, and I don't know that you could put it on a guy for 4 years right now just because of the nature of what television is. Got to remember, Hogan wasn't on TV as far as doing angles, more than what once or twice a year. I guess he was on Saturday Night's Main Event, but even then it wasn't really doing angles. It was just beating, recycled heels for the most part. So, there's a lot less exposure, and it moved slower when it came to the top guy, and it was more house show oriented. I mean, it's just a different business. And also, again, they built the business for one guy to carry it, and even though Cena is the key guy, they pretty much don't build the business for one guy to carry it now. And they also don't have the guy. I mean, they don't have the difference maker guy. I mean, who could carry it, even if they wanted to go in that direction. I mean, yeah, they could put the title on somebody for 4 years if they wanted to, and it probably would get them over. But, Cena's the strongest guy they got, and Cena is not Hogan and never will be.
All right. This person here says,
we got to talk All Japan.
Oh, that's right. All Japan. What's going on?
Yeah, so Keiji Muto is, now there's talk that he's going to start his own company. There's a lot of things going on, and I think it's all going to be kind of a thing where he's trying to get money to buy All Japan from Shira Ishii. And if that doesn't work, then he may start his own company. And if he does start his own company, the feeling is a lot of the All Japan guys will go with him. And if it doesn't, you know, it's a lot of different ways this thing can go. Like you said yesterday, that they're looking at trying to get everybody signed to fairly long-term deals with All Japan between now and June 30th. And if they're not signed by June 30th, then, you know, those guys, some of them may be leaving if Muto gets something going, which is not a definite. So we'll see. It's not like, it's funny because, you know, there's people who I'm talking to there, you know, several, and it's like, it sounds like it's a big deal, but it's really not, in the sense that nobody really cares, because All Japan is that weak, but it's still something. I mean, it's, you know, I think it's kind of interesting just because, you know, of all the active wrestlers in the business, the one who's the most famous would be Muto at this point. I guess you could say Akebono in a sense, probably. I guess mainstream is more famous than Muto. I mean, he is, but not as a pro wrestler. I mean, Muto was the superstar pro wrestler. You know, now, especially with Kobashi gone, I mean, he's the last from that, you know, from that era, so to speak, at that level. And, but, you know, again, he's a part-time guy. You can't build around him or anything like that. He's 50 years old, and you know, he's not the guy who's going to carry a company anymore. So it's not, it's, you know, if he starts something up, you know, there's a million groups. It's not really going to, you know, I mean, I'm not saying it's going to bomb, but, you know, it's just, there's a million groups out there. It's not going to get anyone excited either.
All right, this person here says, I just watched the infamous 2020 documentary in which Dr. D slapped John Stossel. What intrigued me the most was the interview with Eddie Mansfield. I hadn't previously heard of him, and what little I can Google on him says he, at some point, was running a TV production company after leaving the business. Can Dave talk a little bit about Eddie Mansfield and the impact that his role on 2020 had, and a little bit about his career?
Well, as far as his role on 2020 and the impact it had, it had no impact. But at the time, there were many people in wrestling absolutely furious with Eddie Mansfield just because, you know, he broke a code, so to speak, by blading on television and saying that it was fake and all that. I mean, it's one thing when it was Jim Wilson, because Jim Wilson had been doing that for a long time, and Jim Wilson was, like, considered an enemy of the state. Eddie Mansfield was the kind of a guy who was a pretty good talker, who in a small promotion could kind of a star, you know, like in a Kansas City or an Alabama type of thing. When he went to like a Georgia, he was more of a prelim guy. You know, I think, you know, he went to a lot of the smaller, you know, he went to a lot of different territories. I mean, he was good. You know, I think he was in California, as I recall. Continental lover Eddie Mansfield. But he would not have been like your major arena headliner type of a guy. There, you know, when he did the thing, people in wrestling tried to dismiss him as a prelim guy who, you know, never amounted to anything. And that really wasn't fair because he was good, very good talker. An interesting note is that his girlfriend and maybe wife was the sister of Nancy Argentino, who was the girl who was killed with Jimmy Snuka. Hmm. And Eddie Mansfield ended up later, you know, after, you know, basically blackballing himself from the business, he started his own wrestling promotion at one point. He did his TV production stuff out of Orlando, he got rights to tape at Universal, I believe, which is where TNA taped for years and years. I think he taped from there at first. I know he was living in South Florida. I bumped into him a couple times around, just around. You know, I don't know what to say, really. He's still around. You know, he did a show on Sports Byline for a couple of years.
Hmm. Prince says a story that Hogan always tells. He was very unsure about turning heel in 96 for the NWO angle. There were a lot of people in the company that weren't sure he would agree to it. Is there any truth, and was there any legitimate concern that Hogan might not go along with the angle? And had he not agreed, who would the backup plan would have been? And do you think the storyline would have worked as well had it been someone else in that third spot?
Well, it would have been Sting or possibly Luger. And it, no, it would not have worked nearly as well with either of them, and not even close. And was there concern? I mean, not at the end, not in the last 2 weeks, no. I mean, once he was asked, but he was reluctant. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, I've done this way, and, you know, I'm risking throwing it away. And there's, you know, again, in his mind, there was no guarantee that the people would turn on him and that he might, you know, it might be the wrong thing. In his case, it wasn't. But, you know, from his perspective, he was concerned and he didn't want to make the wrong move. But Eric, you know, Eric pretty much convinced him that, look, you know, there's nothing else for you as a babyface. I mean, that was, which was true. I mean, which I think when he finally spelled it out, that there's just nothing new for you to do as a babyface. Give it a go. You know, it was kind of like, okay, I'll give it a go. And once he gave it a go, he didn't really, I don't think mentally he really turned back. And certainly from the first night, he didn't. But, you know, yeah, it was a deal that was, again, it wasn't like this was way thought up in advance. It was only a couple weeks before when they, you know, approached Hogan with it, where they came up with the idea of Hogan. You know, that was the deal.
All righty. This person says, why was the original Overeem-Lesnar buy rate off by so much? And why do you think it underperformed as much as it did? Do you think if it wasn't Brock's final match, that its further matches would also have drawn as relatively poorly?
I wouldn't call it poorly, but it wasn't as good as the other ones. I think a lot of it was on a Friday night. I think that hurt a lot. I think Lesnar also hurt from the nature of how he lost to Kane before this fight. And Overeem, as marketable as he looked and was, the fact was it was his first UFC fight. So it was still, he was still kind of being introduced. And as far as why, you know, the satellite numbers were good and the cable numbers weren't good. So why that would be, I don't have an answer to that. I mean, it makes no sense, but it's very unusual for that to happen. But on occasion, it does happen.
All right, one more here. This person says, if all of the Von Erichs had lived and they'd all stayed in world class, do you think Fritz would have eventually turned a Von Erich heel and maybe even done a Von Erich versus Von Erich feud?
On the way down, as a last-ditch effort, perhaps. But it would have taken that. It legitimately would have been, like when it was hot, no, would not have been considered, nor should it have been considered when it was hot. It would have been, when you know, in 84, 85, it would have been completely stupid. Now by 1990, but you know, it, like in 1990, and then you're going, if they've all lived, you know, where would they be if they all lived? I mean, who knows? I mean, that company, if David had lived and the other ones would have lived and Kerry would have never, you know, gotten in the motorcycle accident. Who's to know that, you know, again, I mean, there was an inevitability about territories, and they were one of those territories that there was inevitability about, but it also could have been, you know, that they would have gone as a group to one of the survivors, and it probably would have been Jim Crockett. It might have been Vince. I mean, Vince wanted him bad, you know, because, again, if David lives, Kevin's interest in wrestling probably stays strong. And Kevin would be tough in WWF, really, really tough, because Kevin was just different. I mean, he was stiff. He was very hard to work with. Very, very hard to work with. He's a fantastic athlete, but he hurt people. And Vince would have had a hard time putting up with it. And Kevin, you know, Kevin kind of was taught himself to wrestle a certain way, and there was nobody calling him on it, because it was like, you're in the territory. I mean, you know, he was the son, and you had to grin and bear it. I mean, that was the deal. So if it had been tough on Kevin in WWF, it would have been tough in WCW as well, but not quite, because WCW, it was a more physical promotion anyway. Still, I think that there would have been, you know, there still wouldn't have been people happy. I mean, I know when certain guys who were national stars went into Dallas and worked with Kevin, they weren't happy at all. I mean, just, you know, I mean, the matches, it wasn't like the matches were bad, but they thought the matches were bad because they were just so brutal. I guess they were bad as a wrestler, but they weren't really that bad as a fan. I never really thought, like, you know, but I mean, as far as like David went and everything, you know, and Kerry, Kerry didn't have the drug problem. Kerry didn't have the motorcycle problem. And Kerry was as charismatic as anyone in the business. I mean, he could have, you know, but again, if you had Dusty and Jim Crockett Promotions, you know, with those three guys who would all have to be superstars together, I mean, it's a lot. It's hard to say what would happen. But I mean, as far as at that point, a Von Erich, turning on a Von Erich, I would say Vince would not have done it at all, because they weren't at that level of doing things like that. And Dusty may have brought it up, and they probably wouldn't have. They probably, at that point, there was enough realism in wrestling in the sense that I don't know that they would have agreed to it, and I don't think it would have been a forced issue. It wasn't something like in those days, you know, like the Fuller brothers would go against each other, but that was the Alabama territory, and also, you know, Robert and Ron Fuller had a certain personality where you could buy it. When the Andersons, and the Fullers were real brothers, the Andersons, when they had the Ole and Lars feud in Georgia, which actually I thought was pretty good, but again, it's like you're dealing with Ole, and you can buy it because Ole was, that's what Ole was, you know, and even then, the feud really wasn't that great of a feud. It was, you could do it, but, you know, again, like I remember when they did it, it was, you know, it was one or two matches, and it was, you know, and then it kind of faded from the scene. It really wasn't a strong, you know, big strong feud or anything. So I don't know. It would have been, it probably wasn't going to happen had they all lived, but the, you know, it's really hard to say because had they all lived, I mean, there's aspect. I mean, it would have been a very different. I don't know if the big picture business would have changed, but for, you know, who knows what would happen with them? But they were big stars.
All right, everybody. On that note, we're going to wrap it up here for today. We're going to have a back issue of the Observer from that 1996 time period. In fact, speaking of the Hogan story, on the front page here very soon, new back issue of the Observer. We'll have a brand new figure four, brand new Observer up in the next couple of days. And, of course, a big issue last week as well. A lot of new shows. Kevin Kelly's going to be on the show tomorrow talking to Ring of Honor and more. And should be a fun time. So that is it from here. And we'll talk to you again after a while.